Good morning and welcome to our discussion on the Gaza withdrawal implications for U.S. policy. A little taller than these microphones. As we come together today, you know as well as I that our world is torn apart, filled with much chaos and confusion. Violence is a way of life at home and abroad. Peace is a distant dream for all of humanity. Could it be that no one among us knows what the answer is for making things better for all of humankind? Is it possible that men and women of the world who call themselves leaders do not know what's wrong or how to fix what's wrong in the world? I don't believe that that's the case. I believe it's a question of will. When I have questions that I cannot answer, I often turn to the words of Dr. Martin Luther King. And just as he turned to the faith community, so do I. And I challenge you to heed his words when he said, "A time comes when silence is betrayal." Just as the time came for another generation of Americans to speak out about the war in Vietnam, the time has come for Americans to speak out about U.S. policies in the Middle East that prevent thousands of children from going to bed at night with a sense of security and well-being. We have witnessed unspeakable horrors perpetrated against innocent people year after year, time after time. And we cannot continue to separate these horrors from our own well-being ultimately. Day after day, we've seen actions that would strip ordinary young people of their selfhood by every conceivable means, that would rob their dignity for no apparent reason and label them terrorists when they dare to fight back. But they keep the faith. They keep the faith for a life of freedom and dignity in spite of it all. We've stood by while U.S. taxpayers financed these horrors and U.S. policies encouraged the conflict. Too many Americans appear to be mesmerized by America's military might, and too few are willing to speak out about making America do what is right. For too long, we've remained silent when America supported and perpetrated the violence, instead of using her power to bring the one thing that would stop the violence. We say that we believe in justice for all, but what about the children in Iraq? What about the children in Palestine? And yes, what about the innocent children in Israel and America too, whose children suffer? When will more of us speak out for the least of all of our brothers and our sisters? When will we move to our challenge and challenge our legislators, challenge our executive branch leaders for those who cannot speak for themselves? We cannot continue to support occupation or colonization of our brothers and sisters anywhere in the world and expect them to love us for doing so. We must stand up for justice now. We must speak out. We must hear the broken cries and feel the hurting spirits of not only our nation's citizens, but our brothers and sisters all around the world. And for all of those our nation would dare to harm through her actions and her inactions. And we must speak out, for our silence, as Dr. King said, is the same as giving consent to the injustices around the world. So many people in the Middle East, especially in Palestine and Iraq, are hurting, and they're demanding changes in their lives by, as Malcolm X says, any means necessary. We stifle their opportunity for a better life at our own peril. The power to help in bringing a peaceful change in the Middle East is within our power if we would only believe, but we must speak out. We must speak truth to power. Collectively, we can make a difference. There is nothing mightier than the power of the people. So, on behalf of the Council for the National Interest and the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy. I conclude with these remarks. Let me say the words of John F. Kennedy, who once said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure now to present to you the President of the Council for the National Interest, Mr. Eugene Byrd.
She's a hard act to follow, isn't she? I'd like to talk to you about the hinge moment that we have in the Middle East at this point, but it may well come unhinged before very long. The fact is, there is a proposed withdrawal from Gaza, which everyone is focusing on now without really understanding what the consequences might be if the United States has to promise away, has to give away the candy store, that is, has to emasculate Resolution 242 in order to get Sharon and the right-wing government of Israel to withdraw from Gaza, which they should do without conditions. If they don't withdraw from Gaza with the provision that the airport will be open, the seaports will be open, the borders to Egypt will be open and monitored by international monitors if necessary for a few years, I think the whole thing will become unhinged. If they have to promise that large settlements in the West Bank have to be guaranteed by the United States, how would you like to guarantee the settlements, the Jewish colonies there, and have your men go over and try to maintain 10 years from now their independent annexation by Israel without consultation with the Palestinians? One of our problems has been that since 1972, we have 73, Kissinger promised that he would not have any relations with the Palestine Liberation Organization, nor with Arafat, and until Arafat and the Palestine Liberation Organization recognized the State of Israel. Now, this came about in 1988, and we finally began negotiations with the PLO in, shall we say, 1993, but we had to wait until Prime Minister Rabin reversed himself and agreed that the only way to make peace is to deal with the people that really represent the Palestinian people. This issue is still there. We have a president who in 3 years in office has met only once with a Palestinian leader, and he has met some 10 times with the Israeli leader that is, he describes as a man of peace and other people say as a war criminal. He is meeting with him tomorrow and negotiating something. We don't know what. In fact, yesterday it was quite mysterious what he had to say about we'll have to wait and see. I presume he knows exactly what Sharon is going to propose to him tomorrow and what the U.S. may or may not guarantee in order to get withdrawal from Gaza. I think we ought to deal to some extent with the fear quotient here. Ever since 9/11, the American public, the European public, and you mustn't forget, the Arab public have been fearful of terrorism. After all, most of the terrorism perpetrated by Osama bin Laden has been done in Arab countries or against Arab peoples. Whatever you might think about the Arab governments, they are after all, the only way that you can control and have security in a very diverse population. The Israelis have consistently tried to undermine our relations with the Arab world. And we at CNI have come up with a proposal for a Middle East peace alliance, which we think is the most sensible way to go about finding a way to peace in the Middle East on a permanent basis. We need a sort of NATO for peace in the Middle East, one that will include Europe, America, Russia, all of the states of the Arab League, which we haven't recognized because of our relationship with Israel, and of course Israel itself. All of them should be included, and we should take the leadership in building such an alliance on a permanent basis instead of having these temporary coalitions. Tomorrow, the president is not likely to suggest this to Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, but I think we all ought to realize that the fear that we have in terms of the Middle East, of terrorism and so on, is also matched by a fear back here, a fear right here on Capitol Hill among some of the congressmen and senators concerning how much they can say or not say, how much they can criticize our Middle East policy and therefore criticize Israel. I think we ought to get across that threshold and somehow get to the American people, because we have done several polls in recent weeks, in recent months, which indicate that the American people are overwhelmingly in favor of recognizing a Palestinian state now instead of waiting a year, 2 years, 3 years from now, or recognizing a rump state of Gaza, shall we say. Recognize Palestine just the way that Truman recognized Israel. He didn't specify borders. He should have, and he should have split up the old British mandate into two countries, as was called for by a UN resolution only 6 months before. If he had specified that the Palestinian state, alongside an Israeli state, was recognized by the United States, and that within the borders specified by the UN, with Jerusalem being an international city, if that had been the foundation of American policy ever since, instead of having this contradictory policy towards Israel and Israeli security, no one wants to see Israel disappear, except a few fringe elements. Certainly, Israel is here to stay. She's the sixth most powerful military power in the world, and she is the 16th in terms of GNP per capita. I think we now have an opportunity at this hinge moment in American politics to change the whole direction in which we go in the Middle East. We should be going into a withdrawal phase in Iraq in not too long a time. This will be very, very arguable, but it is certainly not able to be accomplished. That is, what we want to accomplish in Iraq can't be accomplished unless we have an Israel-Palestine dispute that is on its way to settlement. Franklin D. Roosevelt said that the only thing to fear is fear itself. We have a fear here that we can deal with, both the fear of the lobby in the United States, the fear of debating this subject of Israel, and the fear we have, of course, of terrorism. John Fitzgerald Kennedy quoted very often as saying that you can read it on there. I think the second part of that is the important part that applies to our relations with Israel at this time. That second part says to me that Israel should be helpful to us in creating an international order that would guarantee that the United States would not have to go back into the Middle East 10 years from now, and that Israel would have peace with her neighbors, which is the only real security that Israel can look forward to. And we should build on a relationship with all of the states in the area on a permanent basis. Now, we have done a poll 8 months ago on the Palestine state problem, and it came out 56% for the American public said, yes, we should recognize the Palestine state now. Only some 33% said no. The born-again Christians were split right down the middle. This is the base for President Bush's re-election. Half of them said, yes, we should recognize a Palestine state, and the other half said no. This, I think, represents a change in the American public attitude towards the area, maybe as a result of the shock of Iraq and the shock of the terror of 9/11. We have a new situation, and the president, whether it be George W. Bush or John Kerry, whoever, has a great opportunity in the next year or two to reverse our policy on the Middle East and bring Israel into the comity of nations and make her a part of the Middle East, because if we guarantee the peace alliance would be a part of a security blanket, shall we say, over the area, we would be able to work on terrorism, we'd be able to work on the division of Palestine, the sharing of Jerusalem, much better from that standpoint than from the standpoint of always negotiating bilaterally with Israel and negotiating not at all with the Palestinians. In our latest poll, we have gone out to look into the problem of making Israel more accountable, because we think that's the beginning point for understanding what we should do and changing our attitudes towards Israel. You know, there's a Syrian Accountability Act that is being implemented now, and there's a Saudi Arabian one that is being considered here in this building, in the Senate side. It's already been passed in committee on the House side, I think the accountability acts are probably not a very good idea, probably a very bad idea. But if you're going to have them, then why not have one for the other side, for Israel in the Middle East? Because Israel should be held accountable. She should be a part of the group of nations that is not scofflawing international law and military and other agreements between the United States and Israel. I think it's time for us to consider seriously an Israel Accountability Act, if you're going to have a Syrian one, and so on. We did a poll only 2 weeks ago, a Zoghbi poll, that indicates that 56% of the American people support this. And it's interesting that some 61% or 63% of Democrats support it, and a little less than 50% of Republicans support the idea of an Israel Accountability Act. And that's the entire base. There are 18 different sections to the Zoghbi poll breakdowns. I want to end by saying that this Israel Accountability Act has now been sent out to hundreds of thousands of Americans, asking them to make a petition to their congressman, and that we've received back some 1,500 requests that we transmit petitions for the support of the congressman for this Israel Accountability Act. We're approaching it from the grassroots level, shall we say. We sent up 800 letters in the last week to Congress, all on the House side so far, but we'll be doing that on the Senate side too, with 270 congressmen receiving at least one, and some of them received at least 15 different letters from constituents asking for support and for the congressman to get back to them and tell what his attitude would be on this Israel Accountability Act idea. We have here today, I think, a real chance to hear about both Gaza and Iraq. And there are no two more important subjects in this election in terms of the Middle East than the withdrawal from Gaza and the, shall we say, end game in Iraq. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gene. You know, I always present Gene to you as though the whole world knows him, and indeed the whole world should know him. But I must add that Gene, unlike many of our leaders in this country, has been there and has done that. He served as a counselor and at the embassy in Saudi Arabia. He has served in all of the major peace talks at Y River and Camp David, between the Israelis, the Palestinians, and our leadership. And, of course, he has worked with the political leadership in Israel and Palestine and Jordan and Egypt, and he's a well-known journalist in addition to being head of the Council for the National Interest. Gene, and forgive me for not saying some of those things initially. We want to move on to our next speaker, who is the distinguished Ambassador Edward Peck. Ambassador Peck served as the U.S. Chief of Missions to Iraq in the 1980s and has served diplomatic functions in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, and Mauritania. In Washington, D.C., he was the coordinator of covert intelligence programs at the State Department and deputy director of the Cabinet Task Force on Terrorism at the White House under President Reagan. Now, since retiring, Ambassador Peck has served as Executive Secretary of the American Academy of Diplomacy, and, of course, he's served as chairman of several other groups. He has served as a lecturer and in consultation with businesses, government, and the media in the United States. He is a Woodrow Wilson Visiting Fellow and Distinguished Visitor at the National War College, and I could go on and on and on, but certainly Ambassador Peck brings to us an insider's view and a critical eye to the current crisis that's going on. He's a former paratrooper. He holds a BS from one of my schools, UCLA, another one of my schools, George Washington, but of course I attended all the schools. It's my pleasure to present to you Ambassador Peck.
Thank you, Dr. Williams. Ladies and gentlemen, with your permission, I'm going to deviate somewhat from the plan. CNI's president, Gene Bird, asked me if I could give him a copy of my comments. I normally speak extemporaneously, but I have written this out, and I'm going to read it to you. It's in your folder, but it's much more impressive when I read it, I think. At least this way you'll get some of it. And if I digress from time to time, please excuse me, because that's my normal method of communication. The subject of today's meeting is the Gaza withdrawal and Iraq, two issues which, naturally, Americans in their large numbers are ignoring, mostly because it's taking place far away from NASCAR or the wrestling rinks. And it's difficult to get the United States to focus on these issues with any level of understanding, as all of you, I'm sure, are well aware. With profound, sincere hope that I am totally wrong, I fear the invasion, occupation, and escalating bloody suppression of the Iraqi people will cost our nation dear in many ways and places and for a long time to come. I do not wish to be right, but believe the magnitude of that unjustified expanding catastrophe poses serious and sustained threats to the well-being of all Americans. Notice, this is not something that I'm looking forward to. This is something that my training and experience and whatever passes for my intelligence tells me is going to happen. There is little utility in further questioning the intelligence, honesty, and vision of leaders or those who occupy leadership positions, an entirely different category, who led us into this morass on the basis of untruths, distortions, and covert objectives which are not at all in our national interest. That's my view. The horrific reality is that we are there carrying out actions in gross violation of every political, economic, and humanitarian principle for which we insist we stand, relying on those same discredited individuals to extract us from a debacle they crafted, without shame or remorse, and in a manner which minimizes the damage already done and the risk of worse things to come, is a frightening prospect. This is particularly the case since that band of misguided fanatics, excuse me, that's just my view, along with much of the media, gaggles of pundits, and probably a significant proportion of the rest of us, sees Iraq through a fog generated by the mythical American West of books and films. The language describing courses of action in response to the massive popular uprisings in key Iraqi cities resembles dialogue from High Noon, the OK Corral, or Open Range. We got to ride the bad guys out of town. We got to straighten things out. We got to clean the place up. However, I would suggest to you that Fallujah, Najaf, and Karbala are not Western movie sound stages. And the storyline is not a dramatic but foregone removal of a crooked sheriff or a powerful cattleman by our good guys wearing white hats and enthusiastically supported by all the townsfolk. In Iraq, it is a large and rapidly growing number of townsfolk that we are going after, and the survivors will not love us. They perceive us as the bad guys, not as we see ourselves, heroes bringing liberation, freedom, and peace. Digress for a moment. Surely, those of you who are able to make it to this building recognize that the key factor in human operations is perception, and your perception may be different than mine, and ours may be different from those of Iraqis, certainly if they're the ones crawling through the rubble, trying to save the flickering lives of their loved ones as Americans bring peace, freedom, and hope. Continuing to apply massive, overwhelming, and indiscriminate military force at an uncounted and apparently unimportant cost in Iraqi lives and property has not merely failed to win hearts and minds, it has already generated hostility and hatred in Iraq, in the regional Arab world, in the global Muslim world, and elsewhere. In fact, we have created far more recruits for extremist organizations than they could otherwise have obtained. It is painful, in my view, to recognize and admit, while we see ourselves as doing good in a just cause, too many others see us as actively engaged in totalitarianism. Now, here is a short, powerful quote from an acknowledged expert on that subject. Listen. The root cause of terrorism is totalitarianism. Only under tyranny can a terrorist mindset be widely cultivated. It cannot be bred in a climate of democracy and freedom. The open debate of ideas and respect for human life that are the foundations of all free societies are a permanent antidote to the poison that the terrorists seek to inject into the minds of their recruits. The author of these trenchant, insightful words, certainly in a position to know the truth about democracy, freedom, and respect for human life, is Benjamin Netanyahu. And surely anyone who's familiar with Palestine knows that the Israelis have brought freedom and open expression of ideas to the people in that occupied territory. And if you think that that kind of operation or those kinds of activities will generate terrorism, you are right. I was on a BBC program the other day. Forgive me, I'm off my planned text. It's always a pleasure to work with BBC, the by Americans. And they were mutilated, and they were burned, and they were strung up in trees, and the people posed proudly in those photographs, celebrating what they had done. I'm also old enough to remember the pictures of British soldiers hung from the trees in mandated Palestine by the Irgun and Stern gangs, whose leaders went on to be prime ministers of a country whose security we are interested in, but are not helping. I speak, of course, of Israel. Tony Blair, eager co-launcher of the Iraq disaster, correctly advised a joint session of Congress, right up here on this hill, that the key to eventual Middle East peace was ending Israel's occupation of Palestine in a manner acceptable to both parties. The savage, bloody, and totalitarian suppression of the Palestinians prevents the U.S. from effectively working to solve other problems because our enormous, unwavering, military, financial, and political support for Israel are perceived, there's that word, by Arabs as actively facilitating decades of Palestinian persecution, and they do not like it. To the growing anger and rage caused by more than 35 years of Israel's brutal occupation can now be added the single year of our own in Iraq, preceded by 12 years of a devastating embargo which, among other things, led to the deaths of more than 500,000 Iraqi children. That's a 500,000 people, folks. That's an awful lot of children. On a television program shown only once in the United States, but thousands of times in the Middle East, as you may know, and the rest of the world, that ghastly result, the 500,000 dead children, was described by then Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, as, and I quote, "worth it," end quotes. Anyone who accepts the ridiculous claim that we are hated because of our freedoms has never seen that video, learned anything about Palestine, or heard of Deir Yassin. The universal objective of a peaceful Middle East in which Israel and Palestine exist side by side in security among their neighbors, while difficult, is attainable. If Israel actually removes all its settlers from Gaza, but without destroying every building and facility as they did in the Sinai, that could be a start. Not everyone on both sides could ever be completely satisfied, of course, but an agreement acceptable to the majorities would leave extremists either unsupported or at least marginalized. The U.S. should do everything possible to support that objective, but I fear we will not. In the meantime, and for far more compelling reasons, America needs urgently to recognize that democracy has become our secular religion. Everyone must adopt our version, and we are prepared, if it becomes necessary, ladies and gentlemen, to convert by the sword. That should lead to two conclusions fiercely rejected by the neocons. One, by definition, democracy cannot be imposed. An imposed democracy is a dictatorship, like a people's republic. Democracy flows from the bottom up, not the other way around, and certainly not from outside. Secondly, if truly democratic elections were held in Iraq or anywhere else in the region, next month the resulting governments would not be acceptable, and we would not be permitted to take power because we would not find them fully in line with the things that we want in that region. I offer you as Exhibit A, Yasser Arafat, elected by the Palestinian people in an election certified by observers from the European Union, and we won't deal with him because we don't like him. And our president on June 24th, 2 years ago, told the Palestinians, you've got to have new elections, democratic elections, choose anybody you want, but not him. That is not democracy. That's real democracy, you see, and that's what we came here to force down their resistant, uncomprehending throats. Ladies, gentlemen, let me just digress again for a second. Hand me that phone there, would you, Faye? Look, you know, here, many people in my age group are not comfortable using these things. You know what I mean? It's a piece of hardware. You can hold this in your hand and look at it. You can see it. And it comes with a detailed instruction book which tells you precisely how to use it. But we don't use it because we're not used to it. It wasn't too many years ago, you remember, when you could walk down the street in an American city and tell at night whether or not there was a teenager living in the house, because if they had a teenager, the VCR wasn't blinking 12. You remember that? Because no adults knew how to program the damn things. So here's this, and my wife and I have 5 college degrees between us. I never remember to take it, to turn it on, and I'm not even sure how to use it. Now think about democracy. It is not a piece of hardware. You cannot hold it in your hand or see it. And there's no instruction book. It's philosophical, it's historical, it's experiential, it's psychological, it's all kinds of things about which the Iraqi people know nothing at all. So, how long will it be before the Iraqis have a democratic election? It could be weeks. Take it a step farther. Who says that's the only way? We do. And you not only will have a democracy, you're going to have our democracy. How long was it in this country, a nation in which all men were created equal, before slavery was done away with? 47 years, you remember? And how long after that was the Voting Rights Act passed to do away with the poll tax? 1964. When did women get the vote? 1920. And in 1913, for the first time, the United States elected senators directly instead of having the legislatures appoint them. And the first woman to appear before the Supreme Court was in, what, 1874? It took us a while to get these things straight, you see, and we still haven't gotten them all straight. But we want the Iraqis to bypass all of that and go right to where we are now. And I don't think, A, they can, and B, I'm not sure they want it. Does that make them wrong? You bet your life. And the survivors will be democratic or else. If we, as Americans, cannot openly discuss the fact that Israel's security is being placed in serious peril by her actions supported by us, and that our security for that same reason is being threatened, then we probably are going to receive the sorts of things which the people out there expect us to deserve. That's not our vision of ourselves. But if freedom is what it's all about, and you read the editorials in yesterday's Washington Post, castigating Mr. Mubarak for the fact that Egyptians do not live in freedom and openness, and there's restrictions on this and restrictions on that, and they, by implication, all the other Arab countries also don't have the kinds of freedoms we practice, let us contrast that right in the open with the wonderful situation enjoyed by the Palestinians, who live under the control of a beneficent democracy who has brought them freedom, the ability to travel, the ability to live in safety and security. No. I mean, you know, the lessons that we are teaching there directly in Iraq and indirectly in Palestine are going to cost us. They have. They will. And I hope that I'm wrong. Thank you very much.
I want to thank you, Ambassador Peck, for connecting some of the crimes against humanity by mentioning the lynching of black people in this country. I have to leave this meeting shortly to go to another meeting to discuss that very subject, because some people in this building, as well as others, had the audacity to name one of its oldest and grandest buildings, the Richard Russell Building, for the man who is known as being the one who did more to preserve lynching as long as they were carried on than any other person in this nation. So we have not arrived yet. I want to move quickly to the next speaker, and here to talk about the Gaza Withdrawal Expert Poll is Mr. Grant Smith, who serves as director of the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy. Grant has done much work. He has worked together with a network of academics to establish the research agenda in this country. His research focus is on the U.S. Middle East trade, the influence of domestic politics versus statecraft on U.S. policy, intercultural exchange and development, and he also analyzes the Middle East policy, influences of U.S. policy, action committees, and foreign policy think tanks around the world. There's much, much more to say about him, but in the interest of time, I want to move right now to Mr. Grant Smith.
Thank you, Ife. Before I begin presenting some rather interesting survey results, I'd like to thank the members of the Senate for providing us with a forum to bring together a really interesting and experienced group of speakers to talk about issues that are quite timely. The Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, as Dr. Williams has stated, is a nonprofit public policy institute. We're also non-ideological and nonpartisan in our approach to researching U.S. interests in the region and proposing solutions that are timely and uncompromised. We're very happy to co-sponsor today's event with the Council for the National Interest in order to not only hear from the esteemed ambassadors, but also present MEASURE, which is the Middle East Academic Survey Exposition, which was conducted at the beginning of the month. Basically, the Middle East Survey objectives are the following: try to inject some of the national treasure of our university systems, the insight and knowledge base, back into the Middle East policy debate in D.C., which, as we all know, is awash with policy recommendations, not all of which we could claim are rigorously and academically informed. The population surveyed are academics specializing in Middle East studies, usually residents at university departments focusing and specializing in this area. The goal is to provide relevant insight on key questions of the moment for rapid compilation and distribution. This is clearly not the normal academic process because we're talking about a 5-day turnaround. But the importance of this type of injection of perspective is clear. We're seeking to put real experts in front of the real issues to provide and answer the real questions. Today we're presenting 100 responses drawn from a pool of 2,300 academics in a controlled population, which is equivalent, as you'll see, of gathering a group of 60 PhDs with aggregate experience in the region, best counted in centuries and not decades, to give us a view on an issue that is in need of additional views this week. For those of you viewing on C-SPAN, if you'd like to get a copy of this Insight from Academia, please feel free to download the raw results at irmep.org or by, I'm going to use this word, Googling IRMEP space MEASURE in our favorite search engine. The focus of the very limited number of questions that we put before the academics is focused on some issues that aren't getting a lot of attention. Basically, in formulating the survey, we thought that since there are only about 7,500 settlers in Gaza, and because of the negotiations underway, negotiate a bilateral understanding to legitimize annexation outside of 1967 borders, our first question is to confront and query about the legitimacy of this head on. Let me just back up one moment to say, slide number 4, please, a little bit more about the breakdown, and you can read more about the pool that we draw from in the survey. You can think of these as percentages or simply bodies. 61% of the respondents have a terminal degree. That's a PhD, 14% Master of Arts, 13 Master of Science, 11 BA, 1 BS. That's the terminal degree of the pool queried in the survey. Next slide, please. First question: does the U.S. have the credibility and legal authority to legitimize a unilateral settlement giving Israel lands outside of the 1967 borders. 96% of polled academics said no and provided some additional insights. Next slide. You can read these in the survey. I've simply drawn a few from a number appearing. Very bad move. Israel has to withdraw from all territories occupied in the 1967 war. There cannot be real peace without it. Point two, in 1967, the entire world community, with the exception of Israel, expected it to withdraw to 1967 borders. Next quote, taking land as a result of occupation is a clear violation of international law and will not settle the conflict or increase security for Israel. And the final response that I've drawn as being somewhat representative of the open questions leads to an important issue. Such a move will only deepen current resentment on the so-called Arab street. This last comment then leads us to the issue of repercussions. Answering the question of how would the formal U.S. recognition of annexation of territories outside of 67 borders likely affect terrorist attacks in the Middle East? 81% believe that this move would increase attacks, while 15% predicted no effect, and 4% believe that it would actually diminish terrorist attacks. When we queried the same way in question number three, but asking about whether polled respondents believe the potential attacks against the United States would increase, 75% believed that our risks here in the United States would be much greater, 21% predicted no effect, and 4% stated that there would be a diminishing likelihood. Now, obviously, these two questions considered in isolation don't really tell us too much, because certainly there were the causes which America, in a principled fashion, would certainly pursue at any risk, particularly our principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So in the series of questions, in a four-part series, we begin to drill down on what our academics feel are the relative weights that are being considered to make this decision by the current administration. This is not the ideal. This is simply what they, in their years of accumulated experience, believe is happening. The first question, then, concerns a very important question: safety and security of Israeli citizens. The question is, what factors could be most important in driving a U.S. decision on whether to recognize land outside of 1967 borders as part of Israel? 21% thought it was critical, 33% important, 17% neutral, the rest of less importance. Our second question has to do with whether this would have an impact on our war on terrorism or war on terror. Polled academics believe that winning a war on terror would play a major role in the administration's decision, with 59% believing it's important or critical. So, one conclusion I might draw is that if the administration's in sync with the academics, thinking as 75% do, that legitimizing annexation might increase terrorist attacks on the United States, this might be a fairly heavy weight in the decision-making process for an administration not wanting to increase our risk by legitimizing annexations. However, the following political decision criteria, again, based on their experience and perspective, appear to outweigh the terrorism consideration. When asked whether U.S. domestic political considerations, lobby-driven, will drive the decision, 70%, and this is the all-time high score, indicated that this, in fact, was the critical concern, with 18% believing that it was an important consideration. And drilling down further, one more level, 66% believe that U.S. elections are a critical factor in determining outcome, with 23% saying it's important. Hence, on the weight of our domestic U.S., the weight of our domestic U.S. politics, our academics really differ little than a presentation earlier this week given by Martin Indyk of the Saban Center at the Brookings Institution. Indyk's machinations over this decision-making process presented at Brookings never once mentioned a consideration of international law in the formulation. It was simply a non-issue. When we begin to ask open questions to our set of academics, however, international law is the primordial consideration they have for an ideal decision-making process. Many also believe that negotiations without a Palestinian counterpart is simply a non-starter. Now, talking about the open issues, if you're looking at your packet here in the audience, that are simply raw responses to the survey, which we didn't even have to correct for grammar, as you might imagine, or spelling, because of the group that we were polling, I'm simply drawing out different references. You'll find 31 references to international law as the ideal driver of any deal. And there's also this general and repetitive lamentation of the collapse in American credibility and ability to act as a honest broker in the region. So in summarizing, definitely want to move on and have plenty of time for the esteemed ambassador to give his views. We can summarize the academic response in the following fashion. If the current decision-making process were a racetrack and we had this group of academics helping to shift the gears, they would clearly be shifting between involvement of the Palestinians, restoring U.S. credibility, and trying to have a respect for international law. The drivers would also beware the oil slick of domestic U.S. politics and lobby-driven interests that could essentially send this process spinning out of control into a fiery crash in the bleachers of innocence. So I hope that those viewing will take the time to look over the timely insights provided by Measure and consider the consequences. And with that, I'll say thank you and please drive carefully.
In Israel in 1964 to pursue his studies in the United States, Hassan has been working in many ways to help the Palestinian people achieve their goals, geared to self-rule and basic human rights. He studied at various universities in Puerto Rico to receive his political degrees and his master's degree in public administration and political science. Mr. Rahman went on to receive a doctorate in comparative politics in 1994 from the City University of New York. And from 1974 to 1982, he has served as deputy PLO representative to the United Nations, where he represented the PLO on the Special Political Committee of the General Assembly and the Security Council. After that, he was the director of Palestinian Information Office here in Washington, D.C., and his list of credentials go on and on and on. He has, of course, served as the chief of the PLO and the PNA in these last 20 years. Mr. Rockman has worked hard in the United States and Canada to solve the problems of peace between Israel and the Palestinians. It is my pleasure now to bring to you my brother, my friend, the ambassador of the Palestinian people, Mr. Hassan Abdul Rahman.
Good morning. I'm really grateful for this opportunity to be here this morning to share with you our views on the current issues affecting the future of the Palestinian people and maybe even the future of the region as a whole. I take this opportunity once again to thank CNI for organizing this very timely event, and I feel honored to be in the company of such distinguished people like Ambassador Peck, Jean, and our friend Mr. Grant. Of course, Dr. Williams was very generous with me. She gave me a PhD in comparative politics. In fact, I was only a candidate. I never completed my PhD. I don't want to be criticized for falsifying my CV by anyone. So I was a PhD candidate for 2 years at the City University of New York, but then I decided to go into active service, and I never completed my dissertation. We are meeting here today at a very, very crucial juncture in the history of the Middle East. What happens in the next few weeks, few months, is going to have a very lasting impact on the future of the people and the states of the region. The subject that dominates the discussion today is the so-called Sharon's disengagement plan from Gaza. Although President Bush yesterday referred to it only as a rumor, but I believe that all of you agree with me that it is more than just a rumor. We do not know all the details about Sharon's plan. That's a fact. But yes, it is a very well-known secret what are the components of this plan. The Israeli media, Israeli officials, and Mr. Sharon himself has made it clear what are the elements of his plan and what are his long-term intentions for the Palestinian people and for Israel. First, Mr. Sharon has succeeded, in essence, to refocus the debate from the roadmap for peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis and in the region into his own roadmap. And we should not really be confused about the two roadmaps. There's a roadmap that was articulated, formulated by the Quartet, United States, United Nations, European Union, and Russia, and Mr. Sharon's roadmap. And I hope that this administration does not confuse the two. When they speak about Israel's plan for unilateral separation from Gaza as part of the roadmap, I hope they are talking about the roadmap for peace in the Middle East and not Mr. Sharon's roadmap. Because the roadmap for peace in the Middle East is based on mutual undertakings between the Palestinians and the Israelis, top of those undertakings is Israel's settlement freeze. In other words, Israel will cease all activities in these settlements or any settlement activities in the Palestinian territories occupied in 1967. Anyone who listened to Mr. Sharon yesterday speaking to the settlers in Maale Adumim, he was very clear on what his intentions are. He said that Israel intends to keep four settlement blocks inside the West Bank, and not only keep them, but make sure that those settlements are increased, built, and remain viable Israeli Jewish communities in the Palestinian territories. In other words, that Mr. Sharon is promising us that unilaterally he is annexing territories in the West Bank without negotiations or agreement with the other partner in this enterprise, namely the Palestinian people. So anyone who speaks about Mr. Sharon's plan being part of the roadmap must rethink this position. Because Mr. Sharon gave us the answer yesterday. Second, he spoke about another subject which is very vital for Palestinian-Israeli peace, and that is the issue of Palestinian refugees. The roadmap stipulates that a fair and just and acceptable solution to the refugee problem has to be made. We do not say what constitutes just and fair solution for the refugee problem, but the refugee problem cannot be brushed out of the framework of a settlement unilaterally by Israel. So those two issues, give the two statements made by Sharon yesterday, give us indications as to what Mr. Sharon is going to request from the United States on his meeting tomorrow with President Bush. The other issue that we find not only troubling but also very counterproductive is that Mr. Sharon wants to do all of this unilaterally. In other words, he defines the parameters of Israel's withdrawal, the terms of Israel's withdrawal, thus denying the existence of a partner in this enterprise. This means that Mr. Sharon is not negotiating with the Palestinians, he is negotiating with his right-wing coalition and with the U.S. administration over the rights of the Palestinian people. As if an agreement between Sharon and Netanyahu is going to lead to peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. So, this is one very important element that we have to look at when we judge Mr. Sharon's so-called plan for unilateral separation. I must reiterate to you that we welcome, in fact, we more than welcome any Israel departure from Palestinian territories, whether in Gaza or anywhere. We do not want to be misunderstood as if we are objecting to Israel's leaving Gaza or parts of the West Bank, but we do not want that a partial withdrawal from Gaza or anywhere in the West Bank be traded off with concessions made to Israel in other areas of the West Bank, thus affecting the national rights of the Palestinian people. Because this is not going to be a prescription for peace, but it is going to be a prescription for the perpetuation of conflict and instability in our region. And that's what we do not need. What we need is really a plan that will allow permanent and lasting peace to be established between the Palestinian people and Israel along the lines of the 1967 boundaries, including East Jerusalem, and a just and negotiated solution for the Palestinian refugee problem. And any deviation or unilateral attempt to impose on the Palestinians a different formulation is going to be a formula, as I said, for further violence, further bloodshed, and further instability and pain for our two peoples, the Palestinians and the Israelis. And that's, I hope, can be avoided. Because if, and in the past, we have experiences and history teaches us that when the United States gave guarantees to Israel secretly and bilaterally, not in the context of agreements between the parties, this has led in the past to delaying the possibilities of making peace between the Palestinians. And I have in mind the undertakings and the guarantees that Henry Kissinger made to Israel in 1974 in the aftermath of the disengagement between Egypt, Syria, and Israel in the aftermath of the October War in 1973, in which Mr. Kissinger then promised Israel that no negotiations, no dialogue with the PLO can take place without prior consultation with Israel. And until the Palestinians accept 1-2-3, this really delayed the chances for moving forward for over 20 years. Until in 1993, we were able to sign the Oslo Accords. This has been that kind of undertaking by the United States then put limitations on the United States' ability to mediate between the Palestinians and the Israelis and be an honest broker, I don't say an even-handed broker, because the United States could have not been and cannot be, and it is not an even-handed broker. We know that. But we believe that the role of the United States is a very essential role for the furtherance of peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis. For the United States, under any circumstances to make unilateral agreements outside of the framework of the roadmap with Israel is going to be detrimental to the possibilities of making peace between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and it will diminish the credibility of the United States, and it will generate more anger and more frustration among the Arab and the Muslim world, and internationally also, because that is not going to be a positive contribution of the United States to the efforts that are required to move forward. Israel, in the last 3 years, has systematically destroyed the institutions of the Palestinian Authority, in particular the security institutions, in order to justify the reoccupation of the West Bank, which in essence today is the situation. You have tens of thousands of Israeli soldiers in the Palestinian territories, thousands of Israeli tanks. The number of settlements in the Palestinian territories since September 2001 has increased to 44 settlements at least. The number of Palestinian homes that has been demolished by Israel are in the thousands. The digging and uprooting of Palestinian trees, the summary assassination of Palestinian political leaders, of community leaders, continues, because this Israeli government believes that it needs to win a military victory against the Palestinians and break the will of the Palestinian people, so it can force on the Palestinian people its own vision of peace between. Luckily, not all the Israeli people share this views. But unfortunately, that this Israeli government is the Israeli government today, regardless of the views of a substantial sector of the Israeli society on the need for this Israeli government to change its views and its relations with the Palestinians. The Israeli government tried to destroy the Palestinian Authority, and in effect it has rendered the Palestinian Authority as ineffective in the West Bank and Gaza. It has dissected the Palestinian territories. It has destroyed the Palestinian economy. The losses are in the billions of dollars. It created an economic situation in the West Bank and Gaza that's beyond belief, because in Gaza the unemployment rate is over 35% to 40%. In the West Bank, it is between 30 to 35%. The income per capita in the West Bank and Gaza has been cut to half, so the Palestinian people are twice as poor today as they used to be 3 years ago. In those circumstances, no one can expect the Palestinian people to love the Israelis all those kinds of actions by Israel do not conduce towards confidence building between the Palestinians and the Israelis. On the contrary, what it generates is anger, frustration, hostility, which can be expressed by certain members of the Palestinian community in ways that are unacceptable to the overwhelming majority of the Palestinians, and I mean the suicide bombing, because the overwhelming majority of the Palestinian people reject the method and reject even the concept, because what we want is not really the encouragement of death. We want to make life as pleasant and as possible for our people, and not to turn our young children into suicide bombers. That's not what we are all about. We are about to encourage reconstruction of our society, but the conditions that Israel has created in the Palestinian territories can only be conducive to that kind of feeling. I am not trying to rationalize, justify, I am trying to explain why some Palestinians do what they do in spite of the official position of the Palestinian Authority in rejecting those kind of practices, opposing them and trying to stop them. But because Israel has destroyed the Palestinian Authority's capabilities to maintain law and order, and has created a political environment and economic and social environment in the Palestinian territories that is so depressing. I just come back from 1 month in the region. I spent 2 weeks in the West Bank and Gaza. I was unable to reach Gaza, in fact, although I tried, because traffic movement between Gaza and the West Bank is almost non-existent. The contiguity, the territorial integrity, does not exist. People, it is much easier to get a visa to go to China or Japan than to get a permission from the Israelis to move from the West Bank and Gaza. In fact, people who own businesses and properties from Ramallah in Jericho find it almost impossible to get from one city to the other. The Palestinians are being imprisoned in their own homes, in their own cities, in their own towns. And unfortunately, and that's what is so depressing, is there is almost an international silence. When Israel engaged in all those crimes under international law, we do not hear objections, we do not hear criticism, and the finger is pointed always at the Palestinians that they are not doing enough, instead of looking at the situation even-handedly and try to make the two parties, the two sides, comply with the terms of the roadmap as well as stipulated. And we have unconditionally accepted the roadmap that was put forward by the Quartet. But when the Israelis accepted the roadmap, they put forward 14 reservations, quote unquote. Each one of them undermines the roadmap and makes it impossible to implement. Yet, when the situation is assessed here in Washington, we always hear criticism to the Palestinian Authority, but we never hear any criticism or accountability on the Israeli side. And that's why I hope that this Israeli Accountability Act or law or whatever can become something something that is really functioning, and that Israel can be held accountable, like the Palestinians and the Syrians and the Saudis and every Arab is held accountable, that Israel at least for once can be held accountable in the United States or in the international community. But unfortunately, if it is not held accountable in Washington, it cannot be held accountable anywhere else, because the United States is capable of vetoing the actions by the international community. Israel, as I said, this Israeli government is embarked on a plan that's extremely dangerous, and it can be a roadmap towards disaster instead of peace if it is not checked on time, and if it is not put in the context that really makes it part of the roadmap. It is not sufficient to pay lip service to the roadmap. If President Bush is serious about making Sharon's disengagement plan as part of the roadmap of the Quartet, it has to be linked to that roadmap by timetables, by processes, by concrete steps, and also by commitment to the other side, namely the Palestinian side. But to acquiesce to the wall, to the separation wall that Israel is building in the heart of the West Bank, by acquiescing to Israel's annexation of Palestinian territories, by acquiescing to Israel's views on the refugee problem and on Jerusalem, that is not really what can make a contribution to stability in our region or to the achievement of peace. Those are the remarks I wanted to share with you, and I thank you once again for having me. Thank you.